On the show coming up, we will be listening to an interview with Jeremy Scahill by the Electronic Intifada. They will be examining what Trump's real Gaza ceasefire terms might be.
You're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abonema, here with my colleague Nora Barris-Friedman. On Wednesday, U.S. President Donald Trump and his Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff expressed optimism for an agreement to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza. We're joined now to talk about the negotiations by veteran investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy has reported from war and conflict zones around the world, including Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Yugoslavia. He's the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. Most recently, he co-founded Dropside News, where he's been closely following the developments around the effort to negotiate an end to Israel's genocide in Gaza. Welcome, Jeremy.
Thank you, Ali and Nora. And I want to say before we get into the nitty gritty of all of this that it's really a deep honor to be on this program. I've watched it consistently throughout this genocide, and for 20 plus years I've been a fan and a consumer of Electronic Intifada. And I want to also give credit to Electronic Intifada for publishing Palestinian journalists no matter what is happening. You stand in a class of your own as a platform in the English language for Palestinian journalists to report on their lives, on their struggle, in their own voice. And so I just want to express deep, deep gratitude to everyone at Electronic Intifada for all of the tremendous work you've done, not just over the past 19 months, but over so many years.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Those words really mean a lot to me and to all my colleagues, I'm sure, especially coming from you. And we're really, really happy to have you with us today because you've been doing some really incredible reporting that no one else has been doing around these negotiations. Before we get into that, let's start by listening to the comments of President Trump and Steve Witkoff about the ceasefire negotiations made during their press conference in the White House yesterday. Let's take a look at that.
The military operation, do you have any frustration with the ending of the situation of the war?
No, we're dealing with the whole situation in Gaza. We're getting food to the people of Gaza. It's been a very nasty situation, very nasty fight. October 7th was a very nasty day, the worst that I think I've ever seen. It was a horrible day, and people aren't going to forget that either. So we'll see how that all works out. And Steve, would you want to say a couple of words about Gaza because you just have some information? Steve Witkoff, do you want to come up for a second? You might give them a little bit of information as to what's happening with Gaza and also Israel. We're having some very good talks with Iran. We'll find out whether that means anything, but we're having good talks.
Well, hi, everybody. I think that we are on the precipice of sending out a new term sheet that hopefully will be delivered later on today. The president is going to review it. And I have some very good feelings about getting to a long-term resolution, temporary ceasefire, and a long-term resolution, a peaceful resolution of that conflict.
Jeremy, we'll get into some of the background that led up to this moment, but before that, you have actually obtained at Dropside News the so-called term sheet that Steve Witkoff mentioned, the outlines of this new proposal, and you have a new piece that's just gone up about it. Outline for us what you've learned and what the latest developments are.
Well, some of the terms in this are very similar to what existed in the January ceasefire agreement that Trump basically pushed through just prior to his inauguration. Among them would be that there would be a resumption of aid delivery into Gaza that would be largely coordinated by the United Nations and the Red Crescent, which is interesting because it doesn't say anything about what would happen to the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this sham operation that is intended to be part of Netanyahu's war of annihilation against Palestinians and against Gaza as a Palestinian territory. It also has, you know, typical captive exchange. There's some differences to what Hamas had initially thought was going to be in this. Under this term sheet, it says that five living Israeli captives would be released on the first day of a 60-day temporary truce. Five additional living Israelis would be released on day seven. There would be a total of 18 bodies of deceased Israeli captives that would be exchanged. And the Palestinian resistance would secure freedom for well over 1,000 Palestinians as part of this. Most of them are people that were kidnapped from Gaza explicitly to be used as bargaining chips in exchange deals with Hamas and the Palestinian resistance. I understand that there would be 125 Palestinian political prisoners who are serving very long sentences or life sentences. But where the sort of devil in the detail emerges is that there is language in this so-called term sheet that clearly was crafted to appease Netanyahu and Israel. Hamas had been led to believe that there was going to be a much firmer commitment by President Trump to ensure that there was an understandable, clear pathway to a permanent end to the genocide and a full withdrawal of Israeli forces. In this term sheet, it's language that the Israelis have been pushing throughout the ceasefire process over the past 19 months, and it doesn't lock in anything. It basically just has language in it that says that the mediators, Qatar, Egypt, and the United States, are going to make good faith efforts to ensure that negotiations are serious toward a permanent end to the war. But there's no mechanism for enforcement, and Israel, of course, has a PhD in violating ceasefires. They're continuing to terror bomb Gaza every single day, despite the fact that there was a U.S.-guaranteed ceasefire that took effect in January. It also doesn't say anything about how many aid trucks are going to be allowed into Gaza. You know, the fact that they call it a term sheet, which is a business term, indicates that it's not actually a robust or serious detailed proposal. This is the Trump administration's attempt to kind of exploit the vagueness in an effort, really, and Israel and the Hebrew press is saying this openly. They're saying they're trying to trick Hamas into believing that Hamas has gotten what they said would be a red line if they didn't get it, which is a clear path to an end of the war, full withdrawal of all Israeli occupation forces. This leaves things very, very vague. So what I think happened here is that, and we can talk about the backstory of it, is that Hamas was led to believe by U.S. envoys that the Trump administration understood that Hamas is flexible on a number of issues, how many captives are released, when they would be released, but the bottom line is Palestine is not going to be disarmed, and Hamas is not going to surrender on its behalf or on behalf of the Palestinian people, and that it must include a pathway that is clearly defined to a permanent end of the war and full withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces. This term sheet does not include that. So I just got off talking with a very prominent Palestinian resistance figure involved with the negotiations, who said that while Netanyahu has front-run the process and said Israel accepts this, that the Palestinian resistance groups, everyone just says Hamas, but there are multiple factions that are consulted in this process, and you know they try to represent the fabric of Palestinian politics and consult with people, even those that are not necessarily involved with armed resistance, as a you know, that doesn't have a force on the ground in Gaza. And they're saying that there are so many loopholes in this that, from their perspective, they made great concessions in the interest of trying to stop the forced starvation of the people of Gaza, and that what ended up happening again is that the United States assured them, yes, we have this framework, we're going to put pressure on Netanyahu, give us some time. Lo and behold, Netanyahu comes forward, says we're going to accept this, and I guarantee you what we're going to hear next is the United States and Israel saying Hamas is obstructionist, Hamas doesn't want a ceasefire deal. Hamas, their official position on this, and I think it doesn't get mentioned enough, Hamas has said, we will release every single living and dead Israeli captive on day one of a deal, that ensures that Israel is going to cease its occupation, the genocide stops, and the forced starvation of our people ends. That's the deal that Hamas has put on the table for 5 to 7 years. And they've also said that they would make robust commitments that there would be no armed action against Israel unless Israel attacks Palestinians again in Gaza. Those are serious commitments that the resistance movement is making. They haven't gotten serious treatment in the media. Trump's people understand that's the position, and they went ahead and they once again catered to Netanyahu's agenda. It's Biden 2.0 in the micro situation right now. At the end of the day, Donald Trump's a businessman. He has family business interests in the Gulf. He wasn't just on that tour recently to pick up a $400 million airplane and make business deals, quote unquote, for America. His family businesses are at play here. The only thing that ends this genocide, I believe, is if Donald Trump decides that Netanyahu is bad for Trump's personal business.
Jeremy, I want to talk a little bit more about this and you know the pattern that we've seen from the Biden administration and now through the Trump administration. And I want to push back a little bit on you know the Trump administration kind of posturing itself as catering to Netanyahu when as we know that you know Trump could at any moment pick up the phone and tell him to stop and it would stop. But the pattern dating back to the Biden administration of officials hinting and media reporting that a deal is imminent and then all of that suddenly melting away and, as you said, Hamas getting the blame. Hopes were raised a couple weeks ago because the Trump administration was negotiating directly with Hamas, you know, bypassing Israel. And Hamas agreed to release the U.S.-Israeli dual national prisoner of war, Eitan Alexander. It was anticipated that this would result in the U.S. pressuring Israel to end the starvation siege on Gaza. A lot of people in Gaza were extremely hopeful that a ceasefire was imminent. Of course, that did not happen. There were also expectations that another ceasefire could be announced. Was that all a trick and a deception? Are there any real disagreements between the U.S. and Israel over Gaza? And also, like, a part of this that we don't, sorry, this is like 10 questions in one, but a part of this that we don't talk about is also an enforcement mechanism. You know, every single time over the last 80 years of Israel's existence in Palestine, there are no, you know, treaties or truces that Israel hasn't completely trampled. What would an enforcement mechanism look like to make sure that Israel abides by a ceasefire if and when it happens, and that it stops massacring Palestinians, not just in Gaza but in the West Bank as well?
Yeah, I mean there's a lot to unpack there. I mean, we can start at the beginning with Eitan Alexander, and I know you've covered this extensively on this program, but it's almost unmentioned in any meaningful way in the broader corporate media in the world. Eitan Alexander is an American citizen from New Jersey who volunteered to sign up and enlist in the Israeli army. And when he was taken by Palestinian fighters on October 7th, 2023, he was taken in a military uniform from a military base that has been one of the major enforcement mechanisms for the attacks and the slow genocide against the Palestinians of Gaza. And that's why Hamas has said from the beginning that he was a prisoner of war, he's not a hostage, he's not a captive, he's a POW. And really, Hamas and Islamic Jihad viewed Eitan Alexander as perhaps their most valuable asset to try to stop the genocide. So I just want to emphasize how big of a deal it was that the resistance agreed to release him. And I, you know, in talking to officials from Hamas and Islamic Jihad, the calculus on their part was that they tried to read the room realistically, which is that Joe Biden was a total nightmare, that he was a committed Zionist, and that Biden was continuing to support the war because he supported the war against Palestinians. His 50-plus year career in American politics indicates that Joe Biden was a bloodthirsty supporter of the most vicious aspects of the Israeli project. In Donald Trump, one Palestinian official from Hamas said it's sort of like dealing with the stock market, where you know you have to kind of watch where the money's moving. In the morning, it might be moving one way, in the afternoon another, and then at the end of the day, you have to scramble to see if you can stop losses or maximize gains. So I think that they took a gamble, and they didn't get a single Palestinian freed from prison for handing over Idan Alexander. That's a couple hundred potentially Palestinians that would have been freed, and Hamas has been criticized for making this deal. But I think from their perspective, they felt that the only option they had to essentially jumpstart that process again, and they called it a goodwill gesture. And what they were promised directly by Steve Witkoff was that on the second day after Idan Alexander was released, that the Trump administration was going to compel Israel to lift its siege blockade, and that aid was going to immediately resume. And they also, and they were less confident that this was going to happen, but they were told that before or when Trump visited the Gulf, that he was going to make a public call for an immediate ceasefire and for robust negotiations to begin on a long-term ceasefire. They said the Americans didn't violate the agreement, they threw it in the trash. But I will say this, I don't think that there would be these discussions right now on a new potential ceasefire, even if it's if the one on the table is a terrible deal, had Hamas not made that deal. I think it did pump oxygen back into the process. In terms of Trump, his administration is stacked with Zionists. One of his premier bankrollers, Miriam Adelson, doesn't believe there's a such thing as a Palestinian. Mike Huckabee also has said there's no such thing as a Palestinian, there's no such thing as the West Bank. There is a different wing of Trump world that is not as bloodthirsty or as pro-Israel, but they are in the minority. So I think we have to be very clear-eyed about the fact that this is also a militant Zionist administration that is in power. But the wild card is that Trump is a wants business, and my understanding is that Qatar, in particular, has been putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Trump and linking it directly to the business deals, and saying, "Listen, we did these things. It's not I'm not saying it was a quid pro quo, but they're saying, look, you've declared a new golden era in the Gulf. We're down with that. This thing needs to wrap up." And I think that there was a belief in Doha and elsewhere that Trump was in fact going to push this thing through. That didn't happen. Clearly, they once again set Hamas up as to be portrayed as the obstructionists in the room. And I agree with your point. I mean, it was subtle how you made it, Nora, but I do agree with it. I don't think that Netanyahu necessarily is steering the ship and Trump is caving into him. My guess would be that it's more likely that there are figures within Trump's camp, including powerful figures in the Republican Party that are in the Senate and elsewhere, who are putting enormous pressure on Trump to make sure that this deal leaves a very clear gaping loophole for Netanyahu to resume the genocide after day 60 of this temporary deal. The only reason that I draw a distinction between Trump and Biden is that I don't view Trump as an ideological person in the way that I do Biden. I think Biden's whole career says that he was ideologically committed to a war of annihilation against the Palestinians and would often defend Israel when it was at its most violent, and then became the chief facilitator of the most heinous Holocaust inflicted on the Palestinian people since the State of Israel was created. In Trump, I think Hamas saw possibility, not optimism, but possibility, and they had to make moves that they felt were responsible. And I think there's legitimate criticisms. I've heard it from a lot of Palestinians. I agree with some of it, but I think that the other thing to remember is that the negotiators who are in the room dealing with whether it's the Americans or the Qataris or the Egyptians, all of these guys who are falsely portrayed as living in the Four Seasons Hotel and sort of living high on the hog, they've lost family members. Bassem Naim, who's one of the most prominent English language spokespeople for Hamas, who's on their political bureau and he's a medical doctor, but he was a former government minister in the Hamas government. His mother was killed. His sister was killed. His nieces and nephews have been killed. His family is still in Gaza. Every single official that you meet with from Hamas that is engaged in these negotiations is watching as their family members, one by one or in groups, are being mass murdered. And that's not the case for Netanyahu or any of the officials that are in the room doing these negotiations. So, I think at the end of the day, Hamas is in a difficult position right now. There's a lot of internal pressure coming within Gaza itself. People are desperate. And I think that the framing of it always leaves out the most essential part. This was part of the plan. Part of the plan was to dehumanize Palestinians to such an extreme, to cause them to exist in famine-like conditions, where human nature, especially if you have small children, necessitates that you do anything you can to save your children's lives. So when I see images of Palestinians grabbing food off of trucks or descending on warehouses on rumors that there's flour, the first thing that comes to my mind is this is what Israel wanted. This is by design. So, you know, if Trump wanted this to end, he could end it in an instant. And, you know, I don't know that it's that he's just committed to the war of annihilation as an ideological individual, or it's that he sort of says, well, this is a good enough deal. But I'll tell you this much. I don't think the resistance is going to capitulate to these terms. You know, in a way, it all just boils down to whether Trump decides it's bad for business. And it's sick. It's really sick that that's the reality, but I think it's true.
You've kind of answered my next question, which was really going to be about the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. And Nora talked about that in the newscast. They opened the first of these so-called hubs, only four hubs to feed 2 million people, allegedly. And utter chaos broke out as Palestinians overran the location. They were subjected to horrible, degrading conditions. And UN officials have said that 50 people were shot by the Israeli soldiers or the US mercenaries, and several are reported to have died from their injuries. I mean, what is the purpose of all that? Is it just propaganda? Is it part of the plan? People have said that it's part of the plan to force Palestinians south and then force them out of Gaza. What, if anything, you know, of course you wrote the book about Blackwater, the mercenary army in Iraq. What do you know of anything about the U.S. mercenaries who are involved in this? Just any further light you can shed on that aspect?
Yeah, I mean, a friend of mine, Heba Jamal, her four members of her husband's family, they're from Khan Yunis, were murdered by Israel yesterday after they had received aid packages. Four members of her family were, she's a Palestinian-American journalist, and her husband's family is from Khan Yunis. Her family is also from Gaza. And, you know, I heard from Heba this morning that they were murdered by Israeli forces after they had picked up this pittance of aid, you know, these boxes that don't, you know, they won't last for days, you know, and they don't include baby formula, they don't include medicine. It's just, you know, it's basic provisions you get at a bodega, basically. This isn't real. And, you know, but that's how desperate people are. And there was no coordination. You know, so people go and they hear about it word of mouth. It wasn't like there was some clear guidelines given. Text messages, WhatsApp messages, they're going to be distributing aid at this place. So people descend on it. And then there's an attempt to do biometric screening of people. Israel had announced in advance that there was going to be a political vetting to ensure that no one affiliated with Hamas received aid, which is insane if you know anything about Palestinian politics. I mean, how do you determine who is Hamas? The postal worker is Hamas? You know, the garbage collector is Hamas? You know, so they start doing this, and meanwhile, more and more people are descending on the place, and they actually kidnap some people. There was one case that we reported on where a man from a family goes. He is interrogated by Israeli intelligence officers, and they actually get on the phone with his family, and they're demanding information about some relative of theirs that none of them had been in touch with since the beginning of the genocide. And when the family was unable to provide them with sufficient answers, they snatched him, and he's disappeared, and the family still hasn't heard from him. And they're appealing to the Red Cross and the Red Crescent to compel Israel to reveal his whereabouts. There were more than 10 other people that we understand, the number may even be larger now, that were just snatched. But the intent of this, and Netanyahu said the quiet part out loud in a recent speech, and so did Bezalel Smotrich for that matter. They said this is something we have to do because of some of the pressure on us, even from our friends. You know, they don't want the appearance of starvation to be there. But Netanyahu said this is going to enable us to continue this war, to continue receiving the weapons and not have to deal with any complaints from our friends. So I do think that Netanyahu is operating on a couple of tracks. He recognizes maybe that the runway is a bit shorter in the short term because Trump may decide for his own reasons that he wants this to pause. But I think in the overarching picture, we understand that Netanyahu believes that the best move for him is to force all of the Palestinians from the north of Gaza, where most people are, and central Gaza, into the south to put them into a very shrunken killing cage. And from there, they can just continue to mass murder Palestinians, and when it hits the quote-unquote end, they can lock that box up where they've come in to get the bait. You know, Israel talks about Palestinians as human animals. Then we'll ship that box off to Libya or Somaliland or somewhere else. I don't think this is just threats meant to bring Hamas to the negotiating table as it's sometimes portrayed. I think this is real. This is Netanyahu's at the zenith of his genocidal career, and he believes that that he has limited time left, but I believe he wants to annihilate the Palestinian people, and I think that this was set up for that. In terms of the mercenaries, some of them actually, Ali, were Blackwater operatives, the guys that are there, and were deployed in war zones working for that company. These are body shops, as they call them in the mercenary industry, where you set it up as a way to maximize profit by using privatized soldiers. And, you know, so these guys are getting paid upwards of $1,000 or $1,200 a day to be on the ground. I think it's around $30,000 a month for the deployment. Many of them are former special operations soldiers. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation itself has ties to the CIA and Israeli intelligence. It looks very much to me like a cutout, you know, which is a term of espionage, where you set up a front company and maybe it does some quote-unquote legitimate business, but it exists to either cover the identities or the actual agenda that you want to implement, or to give the veneer that it's something totally different. And I think that there's a little bit of both of those in here with this. And the name is so cynical, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. There's nothing humanitarian about it. It's part of the war of annihilation. So they set this thing up. And I don't know how long they intended it to go for, but the fact that you have U.S. mercenaries, Israeli occupation forces, and on day one they're already opening fire on Palestinians, kidnapping Palestinians, is a pretty good indication that Netanyahu was telling the truth when he said that this is a necessary component to continue our war to exterminate the Palestinian people from Gaza.
Yeah, I mean, I think last week he said something like, we just have to, he said it clearly. We have
he said
to,
it openly, yeah.
Yeah, we have to make it look like we're doing what we need to be doing. It's just, and again, it goes back to this question of, the utility of any sort of meaningful guarantee.
Oh, right. Utility, yeah, I forgot to answer.
Right. No, of course. The meaninglessness now of international law, the impotence of the ICJ and the ICC, and no one holding Israel to account, let alone any sort of responsibility for genocide. And now it's become, this profit-making machine with private U.S. mercenaries. I mean, it is as dystopian as it can be.
Well, and also, we don't know who is funding. It's an opaque organization. I mean, my understanding is there are very likely some Gulf nations that are involved with financing this. And I mean, you're raising something really serious, Nora. And when you speak to Palestinians involved with the negotiation, They're deeply aware of this. How do you enforce a ceasefire with Israel? I mean, there's supposedly a ceasefire in Lebanon. Israel is putting the Israeli flag deeper into Lebanese territory than they've been in many, many years. They're constantly bombing. They're doing drone strikes. They're killing civilians. They're continuing their scorched earth attacks on Lebanon, even when there's supposedly a ceasefire. This is the whole history of Israel's actions towards Palestinians. They never respect any deal. So if you're in the position of being a Palestinian negotiator and you're dealing with an enemy or an adversary like that, your options are very limited. There are hundreds upon hundreds of UN resolutions that apply to Israel. There are world court rulings from both the criminal side and the International Court of Justice that are just flagrantly violated and ignored. The European Union is totally impotent at worst. And at best, it's impotent in the face of this. At worst, it's just an enabler. It's an enabler of the whole thing. Yes, it's positive that France, Britain, and Canada took the position that they did recently. Yes, it's good that Germany has started, to offer some mild criticism. But let history never forget, and Ali is the master on this when it comes to Germany, but let history never forget that a big part of the story of Palestine is that Palestinians are being mercilessly punished for Germany's crimes against Jews and other minorities in World War II. And so there is no enforcement mechanism, Nora, and that's why people poke at this. Oh, who would believe Trump? Who would believe Witkoff? If you're a Palestinian negotiator, what is the card in your hand when it comes to enforcement? That's why they wanted Steve Witkoff to publicly shake hands with Khalil al-Haya, the lead negotiator for Hamas. That's why they want Donald Trump to publicly announce the ceasefire. That's why they want Witkoff to be listed as a guarantor of the ceasefire. They know that none of these are a UN resolution, but a UN resolution doesn't work either. So I think that what we're looking at is, you have to sort of put yourself in their position. They're trying to do things that would bring a form of public accountability. And it's a nightmare. It's a total nightmare scenario. And the only currency that they have are 58 Israelis, 20 of whom are believed to be alive, 3 of whom we don't know the status of, and 35 are... You guys talk about this all the time, but people say, they're holding dead bodies. Read the term sheet. They're saying they're going to give back 198 bodies of Palestinians. That's just a fraction of the Palestinian bodies that are being held by Israel in refrigerators or in numbered graves, some of them for decades. Israel holds dead Palestinians as ransom and has been doing this for a very, very long time. So, I think that we're in a situation where they've decided, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, that the only enforcement mechanism that they can get out of this is public pledges from Donald Trump and signatures on documents and handshakes. I mean, that is the reality.
And there is one other part. So, as you said, their only currency in the negotiations is the 58 Israeli prisoners of war or other captives or bodies that are in Gaza. But that's why, fundamentally, the resistance cannot give up its weapons in this context, because that is the only other guarantee that Israel won't just come in and murder everyone. Like as happened in 1982 in Sabra and Shatila, all Palestinians remember that precedent when the Reagan administration at the time brokered a deal that the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, its armed forces would leave Beirut and withdraw from Lebanon, which they did by sea, and they went to Tunis. And the Reagan administration gave a pledge that the Palestinian civilians, the refugees, would be safe. But what happened immediately is that Israeli-backed Lebanese militias, under the protection of Israeli occupation forces, went in and massacred thousands of people immediately. So that's why the not giving up the weapons is really the only other guarantee, and why I think you're right that Palestinians are not going to, the resistance groups are not going to concede on that point.
I also think, again, I'm on Electronic Intifada's live stream that I watch, so I know I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know or haven't covered more extensively and better than I have, but I think it always bears repeating. Armed Palestinian resistance groups are national liberation movements. They are armed factions of a national liberation movement. And that doesn't mean you can't debate tactics, but that point needs to be clearly stated as a indisputable fact. And there has been a 70-year-long campaign that has been very effective to put Palestinians in a category of their own, that when Palestinians use force to try to defend themselves or assert their rights, that they are designated as terrorists. That's why U.S. terror laws are rooted in going after Palestinian people that support Palestine and Palestinians themselves. And the right of armed resistance is a right that all people in the world have to confront occupation, to confront apartheid. So the starting point for this, with anyone who's serious and knows anything about history, has to be Palestinians have a right to defend themselves against this colonial apartheid occupation regime. Where it gets where it sort of gets problematic when the U.S. and Israel are in the equation, and even some of these Arab Gulf states that are involved with this or with Egypt, is that they're also adopting that framework to describe Palestinians or to designate their armed resistance as terrorism. If the Palestinians were to agree to any terms of disarmament, it would be the end of the cause of Palestine. It's a fact. So, when people say, well, why doesn't Hamas just lay down its arms? It's not about Hamas laying down its arms. Hamas has said that they don't need to be the governing authority at all in Gaza anymore. Hamas said they want a day when they aren't a resistance movement anymore, when there is a Palestinian state that is respected in the world, that its rights are respected the same way as others. And I think that they feel that they have a national responsibility not to surrender the cause of Palestinian liberation. And I think that they're sincere when they say that. So they've identified only a couple of red lines. One of them is we will not agree to disarm the Palestinian resistance. We will not agree to a demilitarization of the Gaza Strip. Another is we will not engage in an agreement that doesn't have a clear path to end the genocide and a full occupation, end to the Israeli occupation forces being present in Gaza. And other than that, they've tried to make concessions. They've tried to meet mediators halfway. Israel is the one with the maximalist agenda. Israel is the one that says, we're going to implement Trump's plan and get rid of all Palestinians from Gaza. So, history is so upside down. I mean, on this stream, it's not. But in much of the discourse, the history is completely upside down as to who the aggressor is, who the terror state is. Who's the obstructionist? Who's the maximalist agenda? It's entirely Israel.
And Jeremy, just as a sort of a final, I want to get your perspective. Let's pan out a bit to the regional situation. Trump alluded to the U.S. negotiations with Iran going well, and in that same White House press conference, he also claimed that he warned Netanyahu not to proceed with any unilateral Israeli attack on Iran. And earlier this month, Trump agreed to a mutual ceasefire with Yemen's Ansar Allah movement, and very notably, that agreement did not require Yemen to end its military operations against Israel aimed at halting the genocide in Gaza. And of course, Yemen's operations in defense of Gaza are ongoing, and just a short time ago, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the leader of Ansar Allah, announced that there will even be an escalation. Give us your perspective on the broader regional picture and how the U.S. is approaching it. They seem to be in lockstep on the genocide. Are they really at odds on these other issues?
I think to a degree, yes, they are at odds. I thought that was somewhat extraordinary, what Trump said, and I'm sure he probably did say that to Netanyahu regarding Iran. They basically told him to shut his mouth because Trump wants to make a deal. I mean, of course, it must be stated that the deal that Trump wants to make, Trump blew up because Obama had made a very similar deal. But like setting that aside, yes, I think Trump is, I think they sincerely do want to make a deal with Iran. I think Trump also sees tremendous business opportunity in Iran. I think that's a huge part of what's driving this. In the first Trump term, he assembled this, the real foreign interference had to do with Israel and the Saudis and others getting into bed with Trump to possibly try to take Iran out and do regime change in Iran. This time around, I think Trump is taking a different approach. I'm not saying that I think that, the deal that Trump is trying to force through is a just one for Iran, but I do think that there is a sincere desire to make a deal, and we hear that also from people within the administration. On the issue of Yemen and Ansar Allah, this is quite interesting because the way it was spun is that the U.S. had punished them so much that kind of Ansar Allah called uncle and, said, stop attacking us. Actually, defeated the United States in that in that series of battles. Where the U.S. thought it was just going to bomb the poorest country in the Arab world, further into the Stone Ages. And Ansar Allah has learned a lot over years of war. They're manufacturing, and it reminds me of what John Elmer talks about also in this program when he's describing how weapons are made in Gaza. They have factories deeply embedded within vast mountain ranges. The U.S. tried to blow up these mountains. They were dropping the most massive bombs they could, and they were not able to stop the production of weapons. The blockade that that Ansar Allah imposed was the most effective response to Israel's genocide from any other actor in the region. It really has damaged Israel tremendously. The most powerful country in the world hasn't been able to stop it. So I think that I would say that Ansar Allah forced Trump into a ceasefire, to be honest. But how it happened is interesting. Senior Houthi officials, Ansar Allah officials, had consistently been saying, our war is not against the United States. If the U.S. stops bombing us, we'll stop targeting ships. And by the way, Ansar Allah didn't attack a single commercial vessel of the United States during Trump's presidency, which you wouldn't know that from the broader news coverage, but it didn't happen. They were engaged in battles against warships that were there attacking them, but they didn't attack any commercial ships. And the fact that Trump signs a deal that preserves Ansar Allah's position, that says, okay, we won't fire on American vessels, but we're going to continue to launch missiles at Ben Gurion Airport, that we're going to continue to target ships that are Israeli or heading for Israel, that was extraordinary. And I would say that it was quite a diplomatic achievement of Ansar Allah, to be quite honest. Biden would have never made a deal like that. So, you know, sometimes people say, oh, Jeremy believes everything that Trump says. No, I'm trying to report on it with nuance. You know, Orange Hitler, that doesn't work. That doesn't serve the public to just talk about it in a cartoonish way. Trump is a strange person. He's a transactional person. That's not fiction. That's real. And, you know, and the things that I've heard from Palestinian negotiators, they often feel like they get a sort of better shake with Trump's people than they did with Biden's. And they're eyes wide open about the Zionism in this administration, the bloodthirst, the anti-Palestine politics, the pro-Israel politics. But, you know, Trump is unorthodox, and I think we do a disservice not by treating it seriously. It's the most powerful person in the world right now.
Jeremy, this is extraordinarily valuable insight, and your reporting is really second to none on this issue, and people can follow it on Dropsite News and on your X account at Jeremy Scahill, and of course Dropsite News has social media accounts as well that people can find. We're really grateful for your time today. We'll continue to follow your reporting, and we hope to have you back soon to continue to talk about this with us. And I truly hope that there will be a ceasefire and an end to this. Everybody wants that, except really the fanatical genocidal Zionists. And you know, anything that gives us realistic, reality-based hope that will happen is worth taking a serious look at. So thank you for all your work, Jeremy.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
I just want to say it's my deep, deep honor to be welcomed here on this live stream, and to be welcomed by the whole team at Electronic Intifada. Deep, deep gratitude to all of you, particularly your reporters and correspondents in Gaza, the occupied West Bank, occupied Jerusalem.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. We're truly honored by those words too. Thank you again.
And that was Jeremy Scahill being interviewed on the Electronic Intifada. And next we're going to hear a series of commentaries, short, brief commentaries. First, two by Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, one by Tad Hickey. We have Yanis Varoufakis, Rabbi Feldman, another Rabbi Mark Braverman, a comment by Prince Faisal bin Farhan, and finally a comment by Francesca Albanese, and she is the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. So first, two comments by Medea Benjamin.
Did you hear that a woman named Merav Serin has just been appointed to the National Security Council, and she'll be the director for Israel and Iran? But guess what? She used to work for the Israeli Ministry of Defense, offense, and for that horrible, hawkish group Foundation for the, quote, Defense of Democracies, both gunning for a war with Iran. And she's literally now sitting inside the White House while Israel is pushing the U.S. to support a military strike on Iran. This kind of dual loyalty would be unthinkable for any other country. Imagine if a U.S. trade official once worked for, let's say, the Chinese Communist Party. The outcry would be deafening. but when it comes to Israel, no problem. A couple of years ago, she wrote an article called In Defense of High-Tech Weapons, and these are the very weapons being used to destroy Gaza today. She also worked with COGAT, the Israeli agency currently blocking humanitarian aid into Gaza. You know, there was a high-level meeting recently where even the hawkish J.D. Vance and TNI Tulsi Gabbard pushed back on Israel's push for war. But with someone like Sarin across the table, Israel doesn't just get to pitch war plans. They've got one of their own inside the room. This is scandalous, completely unacceptable, and it is certainly not America first. Wow, I just saw the new report by the respected polling group Pew Research. It showed that the majority of Americans have a somewhat or very unfavorable opinion of Israel. This is like the same opinion poll that came out in February by Gallup that said less than half of Americans were more sympathetic towards Israelis than Palestinians. These polls are shocking. Why? Because Americans are fed a daily diet of pro-Israel propaganda in the major news media, and they are seeing through it. You know what was most interesting about this new poll? The changing attitude of Republicans under 50. The majority of older Republicans still have a positive view of Israel, but not the ones under 50. This is a major shift. So if most Americans, including most Republicans under 50, have a negative view of Israel, why did Trump roll out the red carpet for Netanyahu in the White House? Why did he just okay another $8.8 billion in weapons to Israel? And when Bernie Sanders tried to stop those weapons, why was there not one Republican senator who voted with him? Come on, Republicans, get a grip. If you have no concern over the 100 children in Gaza being killed or wounded every single day by Israel with U.S. bombs, then at least think about your own base. Are you for America first or for Israel first?
Hi guys, just a quick message for Christians heading into Easter weekend. I know this is a big one for you guys, particularly Christians who have been silent, I suppose, in the last year and a half of Israeli extermination in the Levant. And for the good old Christian Zionists, you guys just, oh, it's so intriguing to me. It's a real head scratcher, but you look, such is the world. I just wondered, have you guys heard at all? You probably haven't heard that all Christian churches in Gaza have been bombed like multiple times, because they tend to shelter civilians who are trying to dodge the death and destruction around them. So they've been targeted like multiple times. Between 3 and 5% of the Christian population of Gaza have been massacred. You probably again didn't hear. Churches in Lebanon bombed several times. Many Christians killed in Lebanon and the West Bank as well. But just to park that for a second, just in terms of Jesus's core values, because I was brought up a Catholic, and I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't love your neighbour and enemy a big part of Jesus's core teachings? Love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you. Matthew 5:44. Mercy and forgiveness, big Jesus teaching. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Matthew 5:7. Jesus famously even forgave his crucifiers. Imagine that. Peacemaking, blessed are the peacemakers. We all know that one. And a core one, compassion for the oppressed. Anybody who's ever even flicked through the Bible would know that Jesus always stood with the poor, the sick, and the marginalized. And it's just hard to see where any of that stuff dovetails with the Israeli actions over the last year and a half. Mercy, oh my God. Bombing, destroying infrastructure, killing mostly women and children, showing no mercy or compassion to orphans, to widows, charring, burning civilians alive in their tents and legitimizing and glorifying it. Extraordinary lack of mercy, you'd have to say. No desire for peace, you know, breaking ceasefires all over the place. I was in Lebanon when they were actively breaking ceasefires all the time. You know, it's an ethno-nationalist state. I think most people would agree there's one set of rules for Israelis and another set of rules for the Palestinians, who they're trying to expel the indigenous Palestinians right now. And of course, Jesus, you know, was all about the kingdom of God, the kingdom of spirit, was totally against ethno-nationalism. Jesus, of course, famously an anti-imperialist, somebody who was tried for insurrection, somebody who was railing against the Roman Empire. I think if he was around today, I don't think he'd be siding with the people destroying the lives of the indigenous Palestinian people when he was a Palestinian himself. I don't think he'd be on the side of the oligarchs, the people who support Zionism. He'd be out in the streets with us, wouldn't he? So anyway, guys, enjoy your Easter. I hope you have a great weekend. But please, please stop calling yourself Christians.
Trump was making those remarks with the criminally indicted Netanyahu sitting next to him. Netanyahu has a very long history, about 20, 25 years, of wiping the floor clean with every American president that he worked with, essentially ridiculing them, running rings around them, and destroying any possibility of a two-state solution, or trying to destroy it, very efficiently, I must add. And there comes Trump with his recruitment strategy for MAGA, which is to outrage everyone, to destabilize us. But that strategy coalesces beautifully, resonates beautifully with, or horribly, with Netanyahu's project of destroying the Palestinian people, of destroying the chances of Israeli Jews to live peacefully, to live safely within Israel in a state of peace. So I am struggling to restrain myself from being outraged, because my outrage is Trump's success and part of his recruitment policy for MAGA, as I mentioned. We need unity amongst progressives all over the world, especially in Israel. We need not to lose sight of the amazing work that South Africa has been doing in utilizing international law and the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice to restore faith in humanity, in our own capacity to do something about the genocide which is unfolding in real time on our screens.
It's not only secular, because the founders of Zionism and the people, the Zionists today, are not only secular. They basically, many of them, hate Judaism. They hate God and his religion. For example, I have a friend of mine who grew up in Zionist education, grew up in Jerusalem. And he told me that what he was taught is that we, the Jewish people, have two enemies. Now guess who the two are. In who the first is. The first is the religious Jew, and the second is the Arab. But that movement, the movement of Zionism, who is secular and who refuses to follow Judaism, they misuse this very same religion they refuse to follow, and they misuse it to justify crimes which are forbidden in this very same religion, because killing and stealing, oppressing an entire people, all of this is forbidden in Judaism. And as I said before, the whole concept, the idea of Zionism to build a sovereign homeland for Jews is in total contrast of Judaism. Us, people in the free world, should say something. This is unjust. This is unjust for the people of Palestine that this voice is attempted to be silenced. But it's not only doing injustice for the Palestinian people, this is doing injustice for the Jewish people as well. Because when you conflate Judaism and Zionism, you conflate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, you're making a statement, as if all Jews support all what's going on, and as if all Jews are accountable to what's going on. But we always need to know better than that. And we try to educate people to understand that anti-Zionism has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Because Judaism and Zionism are not the same. Judaism is a religion. Zionism is a political movement. Should never be conflated. A lot of Jewish people in New York, many of them support Israel, but there's a massive community who is anti-Zionist. And people might not know, because the mainstream media would never show you that. Like, for example, there was a couple of years ago, there was a huge mass anti-Zionist rally, a Jewish anti-Zionist rally in front of the Israeli consulate on 2nd Avenue, Manhattan. And then CBS would announce that there is a traffic jam on 2nd Avenue. And they would not say what the reason is. A number of my teachers or Holocaust survivors, and you know, they were telling stories, terrible stories. And unfortunately, we're hearing similar stories now. This is something that should The Jewish history in the Holocaust should be a lesson for Jewish people how to refuse this genocide taking place in Gaza.
How to be a Jew after the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. I'm a Jew born in America in 1948. I go to Palestine and I find out that we have driven out an entire population and we're engaged in a process of ethnically cleansing an indigenous population, a beautiful, wonderful culture, to make room for our so-called redemption. The Jewish story of today is not the story of our suffering in the past, which gives us total innocence and the right to do whatever we want. Our story of today is the story of what we are doing to another people. Our story is the Nakba, what the Palestinians call the catastrophe, their Holocaust. If we do not understand that this is our story, we are done for. And I tell you, Rabbi, that the day will come when we will be on our knees in contrition and beating our breasts in shame for what we have done. And may that day come speedily and in our times, as the Jewish prayer goes.
And I'm shocked to see how absurd the world that we live in has become, where impartiality to the facts and the requirements of international law generate more controversy than the killing, maiming, torturing, raping, starving, burning alive an entire people as such for 16 months and counting. And yet, this is the world we live in.